Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some call it the last battle of the Civil War, October 1st, 1962, when 30,000 American combat troops descended on Oxford, Mississippi, destination Ole Miss. One day earlier, a 29-year-old black man named James Meredith strode defiantly onto the all-white campus to register for classes, past protesters who threatened his life.
James Meredith has just arrived in the custody of federal officials and apparently making his way up to the 10th floor to register. And in they go, and the crowd is booing lustily inside the Wolfolk building.
Past the state's governor, who had run for office on a pro-segregation ticket.
I'm a Mississippi segregationist, and I am proud of it.
James Meredith arrived at Ole Miss with a briefcase in hand, a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling behind him, and U.S. justice officials at his side. He graduated a year later famous, a symbol of civil rights reform and all its potential, and Ole Miss became infamous, an embodiment of the segregationist South. This week, hundreds of men and women returned to Ole Miss to remember a day of infamy and breakthrough. To heal old wounds and to celebrate progress, a lot has changed in 40 years, and some things have not. In the four decades since Meredith's march on Ole Miss, what hurdles to full civil rights have we cleared in this country? What hurdles remain? And where were you on October 1st, 1962? Do you remember the day Ole Miss crossed the color line? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me this evening from Oxford, Mississippi, is the University of Mississippi's 15th Chancellor, Robert Cayette. Good evening and welcome, Chancellor Cayette.
Good evening, Tom. Nice to be with you.
It's very good to have you, and thanks so much for coming on. I know it's been a big week of observances there on your campus. Chancellor Cayette, we all know what an enormous day in the history of the civil rights movement, of the South, of the nation this was, or a couple of days, really. But for those of us who may not have even been alive then, can you just recreate for us a sense of the intensity, the moment of those days when James Meredith was brought onto campus? What was the scene? What was the pitch of intensity there?
Well, unfortunately and tragically, what started out as a sort of a formal integration process became a chaotic riot. And people from all across, not only the South, but the country, descended on this campus. And we're a very small school. We at that time, there were maybe 3,500 students in a town of about 2,500 people. And nobody was prepared for that. People from all across the country came in here angry, set on challenging the order of the federal court, and being encouraged to do so by some of the political leaders of the time.
And when we read back now, it's incredible and brings to mind just how deep the tensions, even the hatreds were in those days. It was a mob. They had rifles, bricks, bottles, Molotov cocktails. I mean, this was the real thing. Yeah. There were ultimately, something like 30,000 troops on the campus to settle this down.
Well, and they were here for a good while, for most of that fall. The way you described it is exactly the way it was. Mr. Meredith maintained his composure and was escorted at all times by marshals and members of the military force, and I might add the local National Guard. Some of the people who had been in school here the year before were back as National Guard members who'd been federalized and were assisting with integration. So it was quite a frightening but complex environment.
Robert Cayette, I know that you were a student on the campus only a couple of years before this integration took place. You're described as having been a big man on campus in those days. So that we can understand the distance that's been traveled, can you share with us what was it that the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, stood for in those days, in 1962?
Well, this was actually a wonderful academic institution. nationally respected, with graduates in leadership positions across the spectrum of society, and that has continued through the years. The primary difference is that we are now a model for diversity. When you think of a campus of 12,300 students, and 13% of them are African American. Mm-hmm. Students from all 50 states, students from 70 or so foreign nations, a faculty that's about 5.5% African American now, with many international persons on our faculty, a staff that's about 21% African American, and a racial environment that is probably as fine as any in the nation. Just for your listeners to try to comprehend the transition, mm-hmm. I mean, there were no black students, no black administrators, no black faculty in 1962. Mm-hmm. Today, the vice chancellor for student life, the head basketball coach, the registrar of the university, formerly a dean of the law school who unfortunately died, was black. The chairperson, actually a woman, is chair of art department. Home economics department.
But lots of significant faculty and 13% of the staff now African American. This week, you took this anniversary observance and worked hard to turn it into a kind of, I don't know, what would you call it, a kind of turning point, Robert Kayyem, recognition of a change?
Sure, I would say that there are a number of goals for this year-long acknowledgement of the 40th anniversary of, and you all described it correctly, the integration of higher education in the South. Mm-hmm. I think what happened here that day, as tragic as it was, it made the point across this part of the country, and I think really in other parts of the nation as well, that the law of the land was going to be enforced and that people would have access to public institutions as a matter of right, and that there would be no more stonewalling and de facto segregation. Mm-hmm. And Ole Miss had to bear that burden. Mm-hmm. It's taken 40 years for us to be able to get the message out. It's the climate here has been it's just been totally different for a number of years.
Share with us who you brought together this week in Oxford to celebrate the 40th anniversary of that time.
We brought back many of the marshals who had surrounded this historic old building.
And who were fired on and firebombed. And
had bricks thrown at them.
That's for hours and hours and hours that night.
Well, it lasted, I think, something like 12 to 16 hours. Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to say in defense of our students who were here at the time, mm-hmm. that when the arrests were made, fewer than 20% of those arrested were Ole Miss students. Mm-hmm. And there were literally thousands of people on this campus and in this town.
Noted. So the marshals came back. Who else came back?
The marshal came back. Some people from the military were here. The person who had escorted James Meredith while he was a student here, members of the press, members of the National Guard, the director of the United States Marshal Service was here, students who had been both for the integration of the university and opposed to the university, the integration, were here. Mm-hmm. It was a time of reconciliation, of acknowledgement of our civility and respect for humanity, and a time for this campus to say to ourselves first and foremost, and then to the nation as well, that this is a very different Ole Miss from the one that is burned into the national memory as a result of that tragic night.
I want you to speak to that in particular, Chancellor Kayyem. You've said that 40 years ago the nation wanted us to treat everyone the same way. Now we just want to be treated the same way everyone else is treated. Has Ole Miss, has the University of Mississippi earned emancipation from this historical burden?
Well, we certainly believe we have, and I think the proof is in the demographics and in the productivity and in the relationships of this campus. It seems to me that we cannot change the past. We deeply regret, the people of Ole Miss deeply regret what happened here that night. Mm-hmm. It seems that somehow it had to happen. It took that kind of event for the nation to understand what the Supreme Court meant and what the Congress intended and what the Constitution means. But we understand it better probably than anybody because we were at the eye of the storm.
The earth was shaken that night. And Chancellor Cutt, I know how much you've pushed on this in your 7 years as chancellor there, well, how the numbers have improved, and we acknowledge that tonight.
Well, we have. I mean, for example, I went to Yale for a year. I saw evidence of segregation and discrimination in New Haven. I lived in Kansas City for 3 years. I saw it there. When I played football for the Washington Redskins, I saw it on the front steps of the United States Supreme Court building. Mm-hmm. So you find that kind of behavior everywhere.
Ole Miss is not alone, but it was quite a night. Robert Cade, I know we have to let you go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I sure would like to say one other thing.
Oh, please, please.
Please don't interpret anything I've said as being some sort of an excuse or a condemnation of what happened in 1962. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that respect is a value that we embrace for all people, and we hope that as the nation gets to know us better, that this stereotypical mm-hmm. image will be dissipated, and people will understand this is a fine university with a wonderful community. And we invite everybody who cares to come listen, come see us, come visit with us.
Robert Cade, you're broadcasting loud and clear, and we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Robert Cade is chancellor of Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi. We're talking tonight about the bloody integration of the University of Mississippi 40 years ago, September 30th, October 1st, 1962. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined now by William Doyle. He's author of An American Insurrection, The Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, 1962. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York City tonight. Good evening and welcome, William Doyle.
Good evening. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. William Doyle, put this event in context for us. It was such an earth-shaking event for Oxford and for many ways for the country, right from the south into the corridors of the White House. How big a deal was it? Put it in the context of the entire civil rights movement for us, if you would.
Well, the Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, I like to call it, because the university really was caught in the collision of national politics. This was a tremendous confrontation between state and federal authority. It was a crisis over sovereignty. In fact, the governor of Mississippi on September 13th, 1962, declared in a completely unbelievable speech that he was interposing his authority over the federal court order, and in fact, canceling the federal court order, and that he would mobilize all the police power of the state of Mississippi to blockade the federal enforcement. And he soon issued a proclamation authorizing his police to arrest federal police or federal personnel, which is a hair-raising breakdown of sovereignty between state and federal.
This is Governor Ross Barnett, who physically denied James Meredith access to the campus.
That's right. And as a watershed event in the civil rights movement, it is tremendously important because James Meredith, and James Meredith alone, by the way, now he was helped by some very good NAACP attorneys mm-hmm. and Legal Defense Fund attorneys, but it was a one-man struggle. He broke through the holiest temple of white supremacy in the South.
Is that what Ole Miss was? We read it, we hear it described as a stronghold of Delta aristocracy, finishing school for the kind of country club mentality of the state's white leadership. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't know. It was segregated, period, at the time. It was not all white. You go to the yearbook in 1961, 60, 59, you will see literally scores of Chinese Americans from the Delta. You will see Native Americans. You'll see transfer students from Latin America and across the planet of Asian, Arab, and Latin ethnicity. So the whole idea of it being all white is a joke.
But it was a symbol.
It eliminated all black students from entering, and it was definitely a symbol. James Meredith said, if I hurl myself into that school, I will shock white supremacy, possibly into fracturing the system of segregation in Mississippi, which is precisely what he did. And in fact, there were so many troops poured in to Oxford that they basically ran over the local citizens' council psychology and the Klan at the time thought this was one of the most important battles of that period, and the Klan basically changed their strategy after this, which is very interesting.
We'll talk about that. They lost. We're talking tonight about the bloody integration of Ole Miss 40 years ago, September 30th, October 1st, 1962. How far have we come on race in the 40 years since those days in 62? And does remembering help or does it revive old bitterness? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the bloody integration of the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, in Oxford, Mississippi, 40 years ago this week, and asking how far have we come on race in the 40 years since 1962, asking where were you in 62? Were you engaged in the civil rights struggle? Were you oblivious? Were you racist? And was the Ole Miss integration riot the last battle of the Civil War, or are we still fighting that war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from New York City by William Doyle, author of An American Insurrection, The Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, 1962. And now, very pleased and honored to be joined by the man who broke the color line at the University of Mississippi, James Meredith. Good evening and welcome, Mr. James Meredith.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight from Jackson, Mississippi. I guess it's been a big week for you. You were part of the observances that Chancellor Kyatt described for us at Oxford, at Ole Miss this week. How did it feel to be back on the school grounds?
Well, there's a lot of things that America needs to understand, and I think there's no better place that it could be understood than Boston, Massachusetts. Because I think the person that really was the important person in what happened then was Joseph Kennedy, President John Kennedy's father.
How so, James Meredith?
Because at that time, not only were blacks considered as a whole group second-class citizens in America, large numbers, if not a majority, of whites in America, namely particularly the Irish Catholic Americans, the Italian Catholic Americans, and the Jewish Americans, were all considered by the majority in America to be second-class citizens.
So you're saying when Joseph Kennedy launched his son to the White House, that also was a breakthrough, his Irish
Catholic
son.
You better believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to understand, I don't think Mr. Kennedy understood at the beginning. He thought that if you got rich and powerful, it would make a difference. And I have studied history very much, and he almost died disappointed because he was still being identified as a hyphenated American, which meant, and everybody knew that's what it meant, second-class citizen. And that's what my whole thing is about. I am very happy that Mississippi has joined the rest of the nation. In fact, I think it may be just a little bit ahead of the rest. But America is still fully a white supremacy structure from the President of the United States, George Bush, who is a pure white supremacist, on down. And that is what my war is about and was about. But Mississippi was first only because Mississippi was the apex of the whole system. In fact, Mississippi is the one that made white supremacy legal and official. After they did it successfully, they were followed by all of the southern states and a few years later by South Africa itself.
James Meredith, we can hear, even now, 40 years later, the steel in your voice that gives us some sense of why you were the young man who went onto that campus in 1962. But if you would, you were at the center of momentous national history. Take us back. Who were you then? As a young man, you'd been in the Air Force, but who were you to have the steel, to have the nerve to do this thing?
You got to understand who I was born. You understand, my great-grandfather was the last ruler of the Choctaw Nation. He was the ruler at the time. The United States government and the state of Mississippi took our last 25 million acres of land and disbanded the Choctaw government.
So you were not only African-American, but very much Native American. But
yes, at least 80% Native American.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, that's what my fight has always been about. As my divine responsibility is laid out to me by my parents and other members of our ruling aristocracy, my role was to restore the power and the glory to my bloodline, to our bloodline. And that's what I was setting out to do. And I understand this civil rights business. In fact, it is the most insulting thing to me that has ever existed, because civil rights means second class for all people needing the help of the so-called civil rights people, with all other people not needing the help being first-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing could be a bigger insult to me.
James Meredith, you have, coming out of that experience, out of that day when you were flown down with Justice Department officials from Memphis, when you went into the heart of that riot, you have emerged as, in some unexpected...
Let's straighten something out.
Yes, sir.
That was not a riot. You understand that?
It sounds
that
like a riot.
That was not a riot.
Mm-hmm.
That is the Mississippi and the South and the nation using these other people as an excuse. Don't you understand? Every bit of that was orchestrated by government.
By the governor at the time, are you saying?
The government. Mm. It wasn't just the governor. It was not just the South. And that's why America politically couldn't do nothing about it. You understand that?
But we had the White House, and we're going to listen to the tape in a little while here, of JFK talking to the governor of Mississippi, saying, you've got to get this young man in there, into this school. It sounds like...
Yeah, but see, you don't know everything I know.
I'm sure that's true.
That President John Kennedy was the last president of the United States to sleep in the Mississippi State governor's mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a first-term president and wanted more than anything in the world to be a two-term president. He knew if he alienated the Eastlands and the Tamarges of Georgia and the Sparkman of Alabama, he wouldn't make it. So it was a cover. They never called it what it was, an insurrection.
James Meredith, your own son, Joseph, recently graduated with an MBA, top of his class from the University of Mississippi. He chose to go back to this same school. What does that signify?
Well, it is the greatest vindication for me of my entire life, because my mission, my war, was to destroy white supremacy. Now, of course, white supremacy had not been destroyed. But at least my son proved that not only are black, that my blood could be the best at doing what he set out to do, just like Tiger Woods' daddy set out to make him the best golfer in the world. The Williams, the sister's father, set out to make them the best tennis players in the world, and they succeeded. I set out to make my children, and I must say, my son not only finished at the top of his class at
mm-hmm.
Ole Miss,
mm-hmm.
he finished at the top of his class at Harvard University.
Mm-hmm. We congratulate you on all that. James Meredith, you have never been the kind of stereotypical character that might be expected out of this experience, never really embraced by the NAACP or the black establishment. You've worked for Jesse Helms. You've endorsed David Duke. You've run for office on the Republican ticket. What is it about the experience of your youth that after integrating Ole Miss sent you in this direction?
You didn't understand who I was.
Well, I did listen, and I'm still listening.
You see, if David Duke, who was at the time that I met him, mm-hmm. Was considered the leader of the worst Klan group in America,
mm-hmm.
Jesse Helms was considered the worst white government official in America and in the world. Now, if my job is to lead my people and to protect my people,
mm-hmm.
those are the people I need to be spending my time with.
Mm-hmm.
When the Soviet Union was considered America's greatest enemy, I guarantee you America spent more time with the Soviet Union than they did their best friend, who was England.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would much rather, in fact, David Duke claim, whether it's a lie or the truth, that I'm the reason that he became an ex-Klansman. I converted him from Klanism out there in the bush trying to shoot my people to sitting across the table saying he ain't never going to do anything like that again.
William Doyle, please join us here. You've described this insurrection or riot, as you will, at Ole Miss as the Gettysburg of the civil rights movement, and clearly James Meredith was right at the center of that. How do you put this man in historical context?
Well, to me, James Meredith was almost like the Lawrence of Arabia or the T.E. Lawrence of the civil rights era, not the civil rights movement, because he was a warrior and he adopted military tactics. In other words, he marched into that university with 30,000 combat troops right behind him. He thought that was the way to do it, and by God, he succeeded. But even then and even today, few people can comprehend a 29-year-old American citizen who is black manipulating a president and a governor and 30,000 troops to storm the gates of a target, of a goal. And that's just what he did. And I think that people still don't understand that.
And this was no accident. This had been strategized with Medgar Evers. There'd been a lot of effort and groundwork put into this. James Meredith had already finished 3 years in Jackson of university. This was very carefully planned.
Well, he was the master strategist, though. He was the general. And he has always insisted upon the right to think or say anything he pleases to destroy any cliche or any expectation. And if that isn't a validation of full citizenship, I don't know what is. So to me, he's an absolutely fascinating American. I've spent 4 years on and off talking to him, and I can say there's very few conversations I've had with him where he hasn't basically blown my mind and made me think very hard.
James Meredith, there's a nod to you, and you continue to do it tonight. James Meredith, William Doyle, if you would, stand by. I want to take us back to the tension and the voices of that time when the state government in Mississippi and the federal government, at least in the person of JFK on that day, were in just about as great a tension as you can imagine. We're going to be joined in a moment by the daughter of Governor Ross Barnett, Ouida Barnett Atkins. But before we do that, I want to go to tape and listen back to September 30th, 1962. And here's President John F. Kennedy and Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett in one of a series of tense phone calls about you, James Meredith. It's Barnett, a self-declared segregationist. He had personally tried to block James Meredith's registration at Ole Miss. Here is Governor Barnett, and then you'll hear JFK in the standoff of the federal government and the state.
I'll go up there myself.
Well, how long will it take you to get there?
And I'll get a microphone and tell them that you have agreed to be removed.
Now, wait a minute. Governor. Now, how long is it going to take you to get up there?
About an hour.
Now, I tell you what, if you want to go up there, and then you call me from up there, and then we'll decide what we're going to do before you make any speeches about it.
Well, all right.
No sense in there. We got an hour to go, and that's not, we may not have an hour, but it won't take you an hour to get up there.
This man has just died.
Did he die?
Yes.
Which one? State police?
That's state police.
Yeah. Well, you see, we got to get order up there, and that's what we thought we were going to have.
President, please, why don't you, can't you give an order up there to remove me?
How can I remove him, Governor, when there's a riot in the street, and he may step out of that building and something happened to him? I can't remove him under those conditions. Let's get order up there, then we can do something about Americans.
There it is, the conversation between Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett and JFK, September 30th, 1962. You can hear the governor pushing, urging President Kennedy to take James Meredith out, off the campus, not to go through with this. President Kennedy deftly kind of taking those as glancing blows, not insisting in this conversation, but wanting the governor to get up there and settle things down in the room with Governor Barnett. As these conversations were going on, 40 years ago was his daughter, Ouida Barnett Atkins now. She joins us tonight from Jackson, Mississippi. Good evening and welcome, Ouida Barnett Atkins.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Describe the scene as your father talked to JFK in those super tense days. You describe having to actually dial the phone for your father. He was shaking so badly under the tension that he could not do it himself.
In that particular conversation, that's correct, that you just listened to. But before what was said in that conversation, he had urged the Kennedys to wait until after the weekend when people went home, not to do it on Sunday night, but they did not listen. he asked them to, if they were going to do it, to wait until later in the week when people had calmed down and people were back at work.
So, Ouida Barnett-Edkins, are you saying that your father had essentially capitulated at that point, but he wanted to change the timing of James Meredith being pushed into the campus?
I think on the tapes, Bill Dawes listened to the tapes, I think that he said, if you're going to put him in, you need to wait because of the tremendous run the way the emotions were in the state. And I don't think the Kennedys realized how emotional the people were in the state and those that had gathered up there. I don't think they realized that.
Of course, they were getting the reports in of the crowds coming and the violence there.
Yes, and I want to say this. I was in Daddy's office with him when the President Kennedy called him to tell him the riot had started. He was very shocked. He couldn't, there wasn't anything he could do. All he had was the state police, of course. Mm-hmm. He had the National Guard, including my brother, Ross Barnett Jr.
Mm-hmm. Ouida Barnett-Edkins, you know that your father had run just a couple years earlier for re-election on a platform to keep segregation as a way of life in Mississippi, and he had won overwhelmingly. In October of 1962, as this was playing out on the campus of Ole Miss, was your father still committed in his bones to segregation as a way of life for his state?
Yes, he ran on that, and that's why he won election.
So there was no doubt in his mind that that was still the way to go, and once this happened, for him personally, as a political figure, did it change his mind? Did it give him the sense that the wind had changed and he'd better change with it or not?
Yes, he knew that it had changed. He knew that it had changed. And as the talks went on, he knew that James Meredith would be put on the campus. But he said that was the wrong time to do it. He should have waited. I think if they had waited, we did not expect a riot. And I regret that it happened. But I do think that it could have been avoided.
Ms. Barnett-Edkins, I don't know if you've met James Meredith before.
I have not met Mr. Meredith.
If I may be so bold then as to introduce you, Ouida Barnett-Edkins, please. James Meredith is with us, only electronically.
I've had
happy to introduce you.
I've meet a brother numerous times.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
James Meredith, I just want to ask you, you're listening to Ouida's account of what it was like to be in the governor's office in Jackson in those days. What a distance between the experience you were having and the experience she was having.
I don't really think that was that much difference. You see, that because all of what you all are talking about, you keep calling it a riot. There was no riot. That was an insurrection.
Insurrection. We take your word, and it's the word that William Doyle uses in his very title.
Yes, that's right.
And it was not some wild hoodlums out there or rednecks. It was all of the officials and the leadership of the state of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So basically, we are still in terms of full first-class citizenship for me and my kind, not very far. We'll say there are 10 rights of citizenship. I know there are more. We maybe had two then. We might have five now. But you understand, to me, I want all of the hog and none of the hog. Mm-hmm. I would as soon to be in the worst segregation that ever existed in Mississippi as to be in what we're in now. And that's what has to change in America.
We're going to come back and talk about that. James Meredith, Ouida Barnett-Edkins, William Doyle, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the bloody integration of Ole Miss in 1962. Can you imagine the tension, the courage shown 40 years ago on that day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the integration of the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, 40 years ago, this week in 1962. It was an epic event in the civil rights struggle. Was the Ole Miss integration riot or insurrection, as James Meredith would have it, the last battle of the Civil War? Are we still fighting that war? And do you remember the night that drove Old Dixie down? You can call us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 423-TALK. We're talking tonight with William Doyle, author of An American Insurrection, The Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, 1962, with James Meredith, the young black man at that time who was the man who broke the color line at the University of Mississippi, and for a moment more, by Ouida Barnett Atkins, daughter of Governor Ross Barnett, who had put everything he had into denying James Meredith access to that university, who's meeting herself, James Meredith, on the radio waves tonight for the first time. And Ouida Barnett Atkins, I just want to ask you, and I know we have to let you go, but what, in your view, how great is the change since 1962?
Well, I think I'm a prime example of the change. I teach at Lanier High School, which is an inner-city school. James Meredith is very familiar with it. And I've been teaching there for 10 years.
It's a largely black school in Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes, it is.
Only black.
Holy black. Could your father have imagined that future for his daughter, Ouida Barnett Atkins?
Probably not. I don't think so.
Do you think that Mississippi should hold its head up high now in terms of race relations?
Oh, yes. We have more black members in our legislature than any state in the union.
And
percentage wise, we mm-hmm. have more
mm-hmm. that is
than
a change.
than any other state in the union, which is an overlooked fact too.
Well, we acknowledge it tonight. Ouida Barnett Atkins, I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. William Doyle, you're the historian here. Put this meeting of these two remarkable people in context for us, and the whole conversation in context around this insurrection.
This crisis was about James Meredith wanting to psychologically destroy white supremacy, and he went a long way to doing that in 1962 with this single bold stroke. But remember, there's something really important. Mm-hmm. Segregation is mm-hmm. also what history has said this is about. We have to remember that, you know, Ross Barnett has gone down in history as a segregationist,
yes.
and history condemns him for that.
Okay.
Now, we have to remember that John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Dwight Eisenhower, and I would say 90% of white America mm-hmm. were segregationist collaborators. Mm-hmm. They never lifted a finger against this evil system until people like James Meredith put their bodies on the line to destroy it. That's so important to remember mm-hmm. because, and the proof of that is that John and Robert Kennedy secretly authorized the forced segregation of 4,000 army troops in the rescue operation of Oxford and the University of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. These soldiers were stripped off the front lines in a spectacle of a total disgrace, where there were shouting matches, written protests, a near riot in one case in mm-hmm. one camp. James Meredith saw this happening, by the way, and threatened to blow the whistle on it and quit the university if it didn't stop.
So it's easy for
the president to stop it.
It's easy for us to pose as though we had all been on the good, right, and true bandwagon in 1962, but you're pointing out that very few people were, and none but James Meredith was crossing that line himself.
Well, if we want to be intellectually honest about mm-hmm. this whole issue, mm-hmm. you've got to, the first thing you've got to do is acknowledge the guilt and collective responsibility of most white Americans at the time, and that's rarely done because this country has never had a full, I would say, denazification process. And of course, it's not exactly Nazism, but it's awfully close to it. We've never had these honest kinds of discussions, and the very good thing is that Mississippi is having these discussions this week, and I think it will for some years to come. As Dr. Meredith said, it's a leader on this issue.
We're glad to be having this conversation tonight. James Meredith, William Doyle, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, and we don't have much time. Namusa is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Namusa. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm a veteran of the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. In 1962, I was a sophomore in high school, and I watched all of those dramatic events on television, and I would like to thank Mr. Meredith for everything he's done for me and for others.
And what impression are you left with today, Namusa?
Well, I'm a little concerned that the station doesn't have more black people part of this conversation. I mean, it just seems really ironic. It's white people talking to white people.
Well, James Meredith is fully here and with us.
Well, yes, he's one. He was a major player, of course, the major player. But there should be others. I mean, it should be told from a perspective of the impact it had on
black
people.
There is one problem.
James Meredith.
And that problem is the vast majority of blacks in America also believe in white supremacy. And this is second only, that has to be stopped, second only, to Mississippi has been the whooping boy for all of the other states in America, and they want to, particularly the liberal media, they want to keep Mississippi the whooping boy so that all the rest of America don't have to deny or get away from or become non-white supremacists.
Well, Namusa, I want to acknowledge your point. We tried tonight to put together people who were closely involved with that day, and I guess part of the reality is that there were not that James Meredith was not in a great army of blacks integrating at that time. But let me ask you, Namusa, what's your sense of the progress made or not made in these 40 years? Are you satisfied?
Some progresses have been made. When I was a young girl, we didn't in high school, we didn't have choices as to what kind of professions. We had two or three professions, which was why people like James Meredith and others were so important in breaking that. But, I mean, you know, it's still a white supremacist environment. It still, you know, has far, far to go in terms of equity of peoples. And there are also Chinese people that live here. There are Mexican people that live here. We never even see them on TV. I mean, we have no concept of any group outside of our own, most of us, you know. Mm-hmm. We live in our own little world. So.
Indeed, most of us do. Namusa, thank you for your call tonight. William Doyle, what's your perspective on progress made and not made in these decades?
I am sitting in the most segregated state in the United States right now. New York State leads this nation in de facto public school segregation, intense segregation. That's the word used by the Harvard University study last year. Mm-hmm. And we never talk about it here. We never, never really talk about it. And that's a horrible reality because that damages the kids who are victims of that today in the year 2002. So the levels of hypocrisy and the levels of poison psychology on this issue are amazing. I think the whole discussion of race in this country is a form of mental illness because, as James Meredith has spent much of his career trying to explain, it is illogical, it's irrational, and the very acknowledgement of the issue of civil rights is an insult to your civil rights, to my civil rights as a white American, and to any American. The point is we're all Americans, and those rights are sacred. And that's a very interesting insight that I've never heard anybody else point out.
James Meredith, when you look back on that time, personally, how do you feel you succeeded, and how do you feel we have failed?
Well, if I succeeded at all, it has been to put Mississippi on an equal level with all of the other states. In fact, I think it is better than the other states. But America is still wanting to keep Mississippi the whooping boy, so they don't have to deal with the issues the lady that called in talked about, their own white supremacy beliefs and position. But I think that the founding fathers were the wisest people and the most significant Americans they ever were. They established one class of citizenship for everyone in this country who became a citizen.
Except for that little matter of slavery.
No. The founding fathers very smartly dealt with that by not ever mentioning it in the Constitution. And that was very wise. And they knew exactly what they were doing. And now America, after these years, have to catch up with the founding fathers. And I think that's important because Rome is the longest lasting known power in the world, over 800 years. If the Americans follow the founding fathers and establish a citizenship where everyone is equal and American, the United States can last for 2,000 or 3,000 years as opposed to Rome's 800.
And James Meredith, with that, we've got to let you go, but we are honored and thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you for what you did 40 years ago.
Thank you so much.
James Meredith was the first African-American to attend Ole Miss, and William Doyle, author of An American Insurrection, The Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, 1962, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a current Ole Miss student talks about self-segregation on campus. This is On Point. Mary Margaret Miller was born almost 20 years after James Meredith first crossed the color line at Old Miss. Miller, a proud Mississippian, is a junior now at the university. Earlier this week, she participated in ceremonies held in honor of Meredith. While legal segregation is a thing of the past, Miller worries that a quiet kind of self-segregation still exists between students at Old Miss. In this radio diary, she describes the complex combination of pride and concern she feels for her university, her fellow students, and the state of Mississippi.
They allowed the class of 1962 to lead the march through the doors of the Lyceum where most of the riots took place. As we walked through the doors, there was a young black student and a young white student there holding both of the doors open, and so it was just this awesome, symbolic, you know, thing right there as we walked through, and everyone just walked through the Lyceum, and it was just, you know, a really, really uplifting, almost spiritual feeling. And as you walked out of the Lyceum on the other side facing the J.D. Williams Library, you could see the entire university choir and just, you know, the whole area in between the Lyceum and the library was filled with people, and the lamplight from the from, you know, the campus just set this amber glow across everyone's face, and was just really, really, really quiet. No one was speaking, and as everyone kind of settled in their places, Meredith took a candle and lit it from one candle that had been lit throughout the whole ceremony, and from his candle, everyone's candles were lit, and it was just really, really moving as he walked out of the out from the stage and through the audience and back into the Lyceum. You know, it was just almost surreal as everyone just kind of looked around, and it was just absolutely the most wonderful feeling of peace ever. It was just great. I was just so proud that the leaders of Ole Miss had taken that step to make sure that something was done, that, you know, something was done to, you know, kind of say to Mr. Meredith, we are sincerely sorry and we regret these things of the past, and this is all we can do and the most we can do to even make up just a tiny bit of it. It's definitely something that needed to be embraced and something that needed to be brought to light. The riots of 62 have really scarred the reputation of Ole Miss and also the state of Mississippi. So by embracing, you know, the past and, you know, bringing it forward as something that we've got to learn from and that we've got to progress from, sadly enough, there is still a little bit of social segregation. There's no longer any racial segregation. There are absolutely no feelings of ill will towards other races on campus. It's not as though, you know, white people and black people don't want to be friends because it's, you know, this, you know, stigma that was there in 1962. It's just a barrier that it seems the students have not been able to cross yet. I honestly don't think anyone understands why, you know, one race tends to socialize together and another race tends to socialize together. I don't feel like the students want it that way, but I'm not really sure if anyone understands how to take the initiative to make both black and white and international students all, you know, hang out and, you know, enjoy each other's company outside of a school environment. Yes, it does happen, but not as much as it should. You know, I'm part of that. I do have black friends and international friends, but I can't say that they're my true blue friends, like, you know, the white friends I have. And I don't know if it's just we haven't taken the time to get to know each other as well as I have these friends I've known since, you know, I was a child. But it's definitely something I'd like to see, you know, erased. I'd love to see this problem, this self-segregation just be erased. I'd like to see all the students take a huge initiative to you know, right this wrong.
Mary Margaret Miller is a junior at Ole Miss in Oxford, Mississippi. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by